For MeatPoultry.com, I'm Joel Cruz, editor. When the focus of a special report for the meat and poultry processing industry is the evolution of animal welfare over the past century, which was the topic of Meat and Poultry's December issue cover story, the primary source could only be Temple Grandin, PhD, professor of animal science at Colorado State University, and an expert on animal behavior and humane livestock handling. Grandin has dedicated the last half century to improving the treatment of animals raised to supply the world's meat and poultry processing industry with the raw material needed to produce their products. In this week's Meat and Poultry podcast, we sat down with Grandin and discussed how the treatment of animals has been a topic of discussion in society dating back to biblical times. Grandin talked about how legislation in the 1950s began to address the issue, but meaningful changes in livestock handling came decades later. She discussed her career path that saw her play the leading role in developing the animal welfare guidelines, an auditing system that was first adopted by McDonald's and later by all fast food chains. She also discussed how the responsibility for animal welfare has since been embraced by the industry from farm to fork, resulting in dramatic changes in the mindset and practices of animal handlers in the food supply chain. Take a listen to this interview with the always interesting and ultra informative Dr. Temple Grandin.
Like in the days of Upton Sinclair's and the jungle, that a lot of public outcry was over worker safety then, but there was a sense of awareness, at least maybe not acted on, but of the welfare of the animals at that time too. And that was, do you think that was maybe the first hint of things to come? Maybe that people in the public
the UK and England, they already had, stunning requirements way before we did. We passed the Humane Slaughter Act in 1958. That's before I got involved. But then in the 70s, in 1978, the Humane Slaughter Act was applied across all federally inspected plants, where prior to that, it was only plants sold to the federal government, like military bases and places like that. Things have come a long way. And one of the things that's made some of the biggest improvements was big buyers inspecting things. But it's really important to have real clear, simple guidelines about what passes and what fails. That's extremely important. Another very interesting thing I observed when I was working on the McDonald's audits when we first started, which originally some of the first tours were like before 1999, was seeing executives at the vice president level have those undercover boss moments when they saw things that were bad. This is before that show ever came up. But I saw, they saw bad things. So I never will forget the day when a McDonald's executive named Bob Langert, and you might want to read about that in his book. It's called The Battle to Do Good.
Right.
He wrote it up, and he was horrified, and the half-dead dairy cow went into his product. You see, and it was very interesting to watch the welfare issue in 1999 change from an abstraction, give it to lawyers, give it to public relations, to something real. You see, and I worked with the supply chain management side of things. And the food safety auditors in the beginning were skeptical. Erica Vogue was one of the original food safety auditors and real skeptical. But then once they got doing it, they go, oh, there's some things we really do have to change. And then they started working the scoring system and seeing big improvements. But you got to get the suits out of the office. I think that I picked up this cute little cow in a suit the other day. He's from JBS, was giving these out. It's the cutest thing. Got to get the suits out of the office. Now I've got a really good prop for getting the suits out of the office. We'll put him right there, along with the truck I got from our Farm Credit Union. This is what I learned to drive on. So I figured I needed that for a prop too there.
Very good. So that's going back to the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act in 78, you were in Arizona then, right?
And you had a bigger role. I was living in Arizona. I came out to Arizona in 1970. That's where I got my master's degree at Arizona State University. And I moved to Illinois right at the end of 1980 to work on my PhD because the economy kind of crashed at that time. And I figured I'd have about 2 years where I could get the coursework done before the economy came back. And I got all the coursework done. Took me a while to get my PhD because I was working on the calf center track restrainer at the same time I was going to school, living in a really junky Howard Johnson's next to an animal shelter. You only get a room on the dog side one time because you're not going to get any sleep. So the next time I went back there, I said, get me a room away from the dogs.
But during that, during the passage of that act, you mentioned that you testified in Congress and you were part of that, of getting that act passed, correct?
Well, I testified on it. The whole industry was behind it. In fact, our two big plants in Arizona, they would have been Swift and Cudahy, and I visited them often. They were proud of the signs that they had in their front lobbies that they used humane slaughter methods. And the industry was fully behind it at that time. There was no pushback. It went right through. And then the Humane Slaughter Act applied not just to things like military bases, but to all federally inspected plants. That was 1978. The original wording in the Humane Slaughter Act that's caused the problems with having to be perfect, that was written back in 1958. And that's in the act itself, not the regs. It's in the act itself. And unfortunately, it's written so clearly that it doesn't give much wiggle room. I kind of figured out a way to get some wiggle room in that, because if I shoot an animal with a stunner and the only life sign I saw was a corneal reflex, that's probably still unconscious, because some of the new research by Claudia Turlow is showing, it's not so new now, those papers have been out now for over 5 years, is that you have brain dead and then you have fully conscious standing there, maybe mooing at you. And then there's a big gray zone in between. And if you start to get a little bit of a life sign coming back and you shoot it right away, it's still insensible to pain. That's what the act actually says. Now, it stands up, you're in trouble. It's vocalizing, you're in trouble. It starts natural blinking like cattle in the yard or writing reflex. But you can get a little corneal reflex and still be in surgical anesthesia, because return to sensibility is like a computer rebooting up. It's a hierarchy. So you reshoot it in that gray zone, you'd still be legal according to the letter of the law.
Now let's take a break from this podcast for a very special message from a very special messenger.
Hello, listeners, boys and girls. Soon I'll be coming down from the North Pole, not only to spread holiday cheer, but also to pick up the December issue of Meat and Poultry. The elves can't wait to read all about the biggest stories of 2021 in this issue. Not to mention the latest food safety news, packaging innovations, and poultry processing technology. All of these features and more, including a sneak peek at this year's 2022 IPPE. Part of this most wonderful issue of the year. Now don't be naughty and check out the December issue of Meat and Poultry. And Merry Christmas!
So would you say the industry's first focus in terms of species was cattle, right? I mean, that was kind of, everyone was...
Well, the Humane, excuse me for interrupting, I'm sorry, sometimes I'm bad on my timing. The Humane Slaughter Act covered cattle, pig, sheep. It did not cover poultry at the time, but all the mammals it covered.
And one of the first in terms of equipment or tools of the trade kind of thing was the cattle chute was a big innovation, right? That was just generically, that was a big innovation for the cattle industry. And
well, cattle squeeze chutes have been around. There were patents way back in the 40s on that. You know, when we first started working with the Swift plant, early 70s, I made my own internship there. I got to thank Tom Rohr and Norb Goskowitz. former military officer. You know, another former military officer was very helpful to me. That was Jim the contractor, helped me to get my business started. They were using two big stun boxes. And I worked on getting one of the early V restrainers put into the Swift plant in Tolleson, and worked on my first ramp system. We called it Stairway to Heaven. And that was a big improvement over these big stun boxes where you're putting two cattle in at a time. And then the center track restrainer was a big improvement over the V restrainer. But the way this happened is equipment evolves. So in fairness to the V restrainer for cattle, it was a big improvement over in a high-speed plant over stun boxes. And the center track restrainer was a further improvement. You know, that's kind of how equipment systems evolve. And so in the 80s, I actually was working on some V restrainer systems. And then in the 90s, some of those were getting replaced with center track restrainers. And I was laying out curved chute systems in the late 80s and early 90s. I laid out handling systems for all the Cargill beef plants in North America. That includes the ones in Canada. And you know what? Let me tell you how I sold that job. I simply sent a copy of my drawings and pictures of completed jobs to Bill Fielding. And when he saw my drawings, he really liked them. I just sent him copies of the drawings. In fact, I can show you right here, picture of the kind of a drawing I would have sent to him right there. And when he saw that, I just sent it to him in a packet of stuff. And next, like a week later or so, plant called me and I designed one and then I designed others. I also, in the early 90s, wrote the first AMI guideline with Janet Riley, which covered just basic cattle handling principles, flight zone, point of balance. And then in 1997, after I did a survey for the USDA, I developed the scoring system that's used by the North American Meat Institute now. And then things really took off with that when McDonald's grabbed the hold of that scoring system 2 years later. But one of the reasons why the industry didn't totally have a fight is I never made a plant do something stupid. I bent over backwards to make whatever they had there work. I did not shove equipment down their throat. It's amazing what a non-slip floor in a stun box does. Something that simple, just to settle the animal down. Or you put a light on the chute entrance. They're afraid of the dark. So I duct tape a light on that chute entrance and they go right in. Put a false floor in a restrainer so they don't see, look down and go, ah, a cliff. So I stick cardboard under there for proof of concept. And then I go, okay, now we're get that replaced with metal. You know, that's something, those are simple things. I'm really proud of the fact that only three of those plants had to build an expensive front end. Those 75 of them, the rest of them, we fixed simple things, lots of training and three manager removals. Also, unfortunately, we found there were some employees that, I mean, some people enjoy torturing animals and they had to be removed. You know, that's not a nice thing to say, but that's something we learned back in 1999 when we were implementing that. And then when the AeroSight video cameras came in 10 years later, there was another round of employees that had to be removed.
So as you initially worked with the cattle industry, how did the progress and how did you divide your work and when did like the hog industry catch up or it, you know, how did those two coexist in terms
my
of
my first hog job? My very first hog job was Conn's in Cincinnati. I think it's all been torn down now. I was in there in 1980, old stockyard, looks like a parking ramp where you've got cattle and pigs on more than one floor. And I was hired to do a job where we had to rip out all the horrible old busted up wooden pens, dirtiest thing that ever was, and make a good stockyard out of it. It's also where I learned a serious lesson that I'm glad from an engineering standpoint, I learned at an early age. Do not try to fix genetic problems in pigs with equipment. Please do not try to do that. Now the pigs they had at the time had to walk up to the third floor in this ancient old plant. And there were some pigs that were not able to walk up to the third floor. So they wanted me to put a conveyor in the bottom of the chute to take them up there. Well, all it did is flip the pigs over backwards. It was a complete mess. And then I started looking at which pigs couldn't walk up the ramp. And they were almost all the same tattoo number. We could have replaced the boars at one farm and fixed the problem. And what I learned from that after we tore this whole mess out and moved all the equipment down a floor is that don't try to fix genetic problems in pigs with engineering. Okay, at the Utica veal plant, our large 375-pound veal calves worked just great in the system. But this plant also slaughtered baby bob veal. And they were bringing in baby bob veal that were not able to walk. They shouldn't have been brought in. They were not mobile. And so they had me put conveyors all over the floor to move them. Stupid, stupid. Now, you've got to fix root causes of problems. I went into a 6 month of depression over that. You know, now there is a little conveyor thing that you put right at the entrance to a restrainer that does help get pigs and cattle in, but not just putting conveyors all over everything. And this brings up another important thing. I got to have animals that can walk, period. And after we got the McDonald's audits going, we had the AeroSight cameras in, things were just great. I was so happy. Then we started getting mobility issues in cattle. And I'm going, oh no. And in the beginning, I think it was beta agonists caused most of the problems in hot weather. And then after the export market banned the beta agonists, then we started getting problems with mobility in cattle that were genetic, as it was selecting for more and more meat, which was leg conformation issues. And the thing that was kind of interesting is that the leg conformation issues in the cattle were the same problems you had in the pigs, too straight, collapsed ankles, or crooked. And I think it's starting to turn the corner now and get better. There's a lot of lameness scoring going on, but you have to have animals that have mobility. You know, baby calves that are day old, they don't walk very well, especially dairy calves. Got to have animals that can walk. And there's a lot of concern about transportation. The problems that I saw in fed beef, let's not blame the truckers for that. These problems are originating back on the farm. In fact, I got a paper I just wrote up about, you have to have, in order to have high meat quality, you need to have animals that will move easily. So a lot of people have corrected these problems. My students were just out at one of the plants. I'm working with Lily Calloway Edwards on the night shift. I was happy when Danielle told me that the cattle were coming off the trucks really nicely. But there is a few places where they're bringing in really lame cattle on the night shift, and that's not okay. You've got to have animals with good mobility. You've got to have animals that can handle. Same thing's true for pigs. Got to have animals that you cannot handle.
So when did that, can you kind of put your finger on when did the emphasis or the focus of the industry kind of turn to transportation and what that part of the process, when did that become kind of a focal point?
Well, there's been some problems. You know, there's been abuse of downed dairy cows. I mean, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, somebody tied a chain to a dairy cow and dragged it off the loading ramp by driving the truck off. Yeah, stuff like that's clearly not acceptable. And I think it's really good. Truckers now have been having to do beef quality assurance, pork quality assurance. That's really a good thing. And I would say now handling's really improved. I mean, the National Cattlemen's Association has put a lot of emphasis on handling. The Pork Board has put a lot of emphasis on handling. That's wonderful. I'm really happy about that. Handling's improved. But just as we're getting handling good, we started to get problems with animals with mobility issues. Well, that makes them difficult to handle. Now, I think it's just now more recently starting to get better, but you need to score them on the night shift too. Otherwise they're gonna save the bad stuff for the night shift. Another thing that can be an issue is cattle that have only been handled on horseback. And then when you get them in a plant, it's super wild because a person walking on the ground is something new and novel and scary, and that can be a dangerous situation. So before an animal leaves the farm, in order to have good transportation and good, low stress handling, got to give me a mobile animal that's not wild and completely crazy. That's just essential. Otherwise it's impossible to have really good handling at a plant or not have problems on trucks. You also have to have, don't overload the truck, And the drivers have got to not stomp on the gas and stomp on the brake because that throws them off balance.
And that was something I was going to mention too. I through the years, and you know, going back to the industry's very beginning, that there's a certain skill set that maybe wasn't honored or wasn't looked for among employees who handle livestock. That it's kind of a big push now in the industry. Can you talk about kind of the what makes a good animal handler? What, you know, what, how did it used to be, and how is it now?
Well, a calm person makes a good animal handler. And even back in the bad old days, there were a few people that handled animals right. In fact, there's one guy I can think of right now that works at one of the plants, older guy, a little bit overweight, kind of lazy. He's absolutely great working the cattle crowd pen. And good handling there is going to take more walking to bring up small groups of cattle, because you're going to have to walk back and forth through the yards more. And you have to figure out in your facility what's the correct amount of pigs to bring up at the time, and the correct amount of cattle, and then you have to enforce that. So good handling requires a lot more walking. The other thing that was good is that when I first started, they used to put every light duty employee out in the yards to go poke at cattle or pigs with electric prod. People are not doing that anymore. The handling jobs are getting somewhat better pay, getting better status, get stickers for their hats. I think this is all positive, recognizing that handling's not just a flunky job, it's a really important job. And that's something good that's happened.
Make sure to check out the latest monthly features for Meat and Poultry's print edition and stay on top of daily industry news online at meatpoultry.com. Also, follow us on social media on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram, all by searching at Meat Poultry. And if you liked or didn't like what you heard, or if you have suggestions for future topics or guests, please leave us a rating and review. Your feedback is really valuable as we develop future podcast topics. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.